Hi, I'm Kathy Forstein, Music Director, KC Cafe Radio. It's a great pleasure to once again be talking with Las Vegas Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member John Batdorf. John has had a long, successful career going back to the early 70s, first as a part of the duo Batdorf and Rodney, then with the top 40 group Silver, and later as a studio musician, writing music for television, and most recently as a solo act. His newest album, Next Stop Willoughby, is full of more memorable songs that engage the listener. Thanks so much, John Batdorf, for taking the time to chat with me today on KC Cafe Radio.
Well, thank you, Kathy. It's nice to be here.
It's good to hear your voice again and see you again.
Yeah, it's been a while. I haven't been able to make it out to any of the Folk Alliance things. I've just been working. I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing to be working when you're a musician.
Yeah, that is good.
The newest album, Next Stop Willoughby, is a great album. I understand that the title track was inspired by an episode of The Twilight Zone.
It was, and it had a lot to do with, when I was a kid, I loved The Twilight Zone, and one of the most memorable episodes was the Willoughby episode, where it was a story about a guy who was a stressed-out ad guy in New York, and he was just about ready to pop, and his wife was all over him, and the boss was all over him, and he was just fed up, so he took this train ride that he thought was going to on a business trip and ended up in this place. He woke up and ended up in a place, and the conductor says, "Next stop, Willoughby." And he had never heard of Willoughby and said, "Well, what is this place?" And the conductor said, "It's a place where a man can live his life full measure." And he looked outside, and there were people riding bikes and people playing music and smiling and laughing, and it was everything he had missed in his life. So, you know, that stuck with me for a long time. I've seen it several times. And when my wife and I were looking for a new place to live, we lived in Southern California most of our whole lives. We found this place here in Central Oregon that we didn't even know existed, and it's called Eagle Crest. And when we drove onto the property and saw what a magnificent place it was, I thought, my gosh, this is Willoughby. We found our Willoughby. So, you know, I just put out Beep Beep about, gosh, maybe 6 months before that. And I guess it was just being around the new surroundings. I was inspired to write more songs. And one of the songs I wrote was a song, Willoughby, which is about the Twilight Zone episode. And also it turns that the song is really about us finding our Willoughby.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah, it's a cool thing. I mean, it's amazing what you remember when you're a kid and what an impact it has. Just like, gosh, mm-hmm. The Beatles were me as well.
Yeah. So everybody has their own Willoughby, right?
I think so, because, you know, what was funny was when I put the record out, so many people were saying that, well, I found my Willoughby here in Florida, or I found my Willoughby here in Columbia, Missouri. And it's really funny that people remember that show and they relate to the subject matter. So it was great. I'd never written a song about a TV show before and didn't really plan it. It just came out, and I'm glad it did.
Yeah, that's a great song. So where did you record this album at?
Well, I have my own studio here in Oregon, and it's the first thing I put together because I brought all my stuff up. Didn't put it in the moving van. Had my studio set up. And I got a nice big room here with nice high ceilings, and it's well-tuned. And so I just brought all my gear from L.A., and now I sit in this room, and I'm, you know, working on music again because it's here. It's so great to have your own home studio because you can just walk out, get an idea, and lay it down. And instead of having to book a studio, booking players and all that stuff, it's nice to have access to it all the time.
Yeah, and when you're talented enough to do most of the music yourself, you don't have to worry about not bringing other people in, too.
That does help. You know, it's nice to know as much about everything as you can. As if you're in the field of music, you want to understand percussion, you want to understand arranging, you want to understand producing, you want to understand engineering, because the more you know, the better off you are.
Is this like a digital studio, or are you using like old-time analog? What are you doing?
Well, I'm the old-time analog guy. But the rest of the stuff is digital, although I do have some nice old tube mic pre's, and I have a nice mic with a tube in it, which gives it that really nice analog warmth. But I love recording digitally. My whole career in the 70s and the early 80s was all on 2-inch tape. The fact that, you know, analog had such a nice warm sound, and digital, when it first came out, was a little more brittle, a little more exposed, kind of like when HDTV first came out. Everything looked too clear. It was kind of hard to get your eye used to it. And eventually they perfected it, and that's what they've done with the digital recording. There are so many companies now that make incredible plugins that give it the nice warm analog sound, and I use Universal Audio plugins that are so fantastic. And it's nice to be able to have a visual of, you know, you hear a phrase. Sometimes when you sang a line, you think, gosh, if I could just slide it over a little bit left or right, it would feel better in the pocket. And with analog, it's basically impossible to do that. So it's so great to be able to look and just nudge it over here, left or right, and, you know, have it be as good as you could possibly make it. That's why I like digital recording so much.
Mm-hmm. And they've perfected it enough now where it doesn't sound like perfection like it used to.
No.
Sometimes it just sounded too perfect. And you want to have that little bit of wiggle room in there where it's not so perfect.
Yeah, you know, what's funny, and when the Beatles just released their CDs, I think it was, gosh, it must have been like 85 or 86, when CD players were just coming in, I was actually disappointed in the way they sounded because I was so used to the way the record sounded. And when they made them digital, it unmasked a lot of stuff that was hidden in that analog, just the tape saturation and the wow and flutter. And I really liked it better the other way. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. It needs some real life air and just life in the tracks. Otherwise, it does sound too sterile.
Did you get the new Sgt. Pepper thing they put out? Did you listen to that?
No, I have not yet.
It's very good. I mean, it's done really well. It's done by George Martin's son. And he did an excellent job on this. I mean, it was what the Beatles, I think, originally envisioned the sound of the album to be. It's pretty good.
Well, I have to hear it.
Yeah.
I have to hear it.
It's really good. You did your first solo album probably in 2005, is that right?
Yes, and it only happened because I've been working on TV for the 8 years prior to that, and I got a call from James Lee Stanley, who's someone that I met in the 70s, and he wanted to know if I'd want to work on a project with him, a thing called All Wooden Stones, which was going to be like acoustic versions of early Rolling Stones songs. And I was just finishing up a TV pilot, and I had a little time. And so I said, sure, I think I can do it. And we were supposed to be done in a month, and it took over 6 months to do it. In the meantime, I was writing songs. I'm thinking, gosh, if I'm going to record again, which I hadn't ever planned on ever doing again, and the TV thing kind of went away, I started writing songs, and I didn't have time to make a full album before we went out on the road, which eventually we did about 6 months later. So I recorded an EP, and that was my first original recording since I put out a CD with Michael McLean, Don't You Know. And so from that point on, I've got 6 solo CDs and 2 All Wooden Stones CDs, a Soundtracks Recovery CD, and a Live at XM CD. So I've been busy.
I've been very busy, yeah.
No, I really love it. I just love the process. I've always created music my whole life, but I love creating songs. It's just, it's really a complete joy.
Mm-hmm. How would you say your music's changed since that first CD in 2005?
Well, I think when in 2005, you know, I didn't really know what I was as a solo act. I just recorded these songs with really, I mean, how could I have any direction? Because I hadn't really thought about being a solo act in, you know, so many years. And initially, before I met Mark, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a solo act. But I met Mark and it was so good together that, you know, we went with the Bad Dolphin Rodney thing. So I know that by making that first EP, I really liked it. And then I started playing live, and during the show, because we only had 12 Rolling Stones songs, or 11, I think, I had to sing some songs. I didn't want to sing old Bad Dolphin Rodney songs so much. So I started singing the new stuff, and as I played the new stuff more and more, I kind of felt like I kind of felt comfortable, and I felt like I had a direction on where I wanted to go. And by the time I made my first full-length CD, the Home Again CD, I was really on my way to creating the sound that I thought I wanted to be like as a solo act.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a while, you know, because it's not just a person. It's also, you know, it's an act. It's something that you are unique in offering. And it doesn't just come after, because I've played in a band pretty much my whole life, either as a duet or in a band. And it's a whole different thing. Now I'm very comfortable doing it by myself. And I love going out doing shows by myself. So it's, you know, it's great. And you never know what life's bringing. So I'm really happy that I've come back and recorded all these new songs. It's been great.
Mm-hmm. So you think performing solo has made you a better musician?
I think so, because I had to. Yeah, I think so. for one thing, if you make a mistake, you can't look at the other guy, which I used to always do to make people think that he was the one. So now you're kind of on your own, and I think that it causes you to, which you always should anyway, but you're very focused on the playing, on the singing, and on the just the communication with the crowd. You know, I never used to talk much on stage. I didn't know what to say. I just thought we were there to sing and play. And when I go out now, I only have one guitar because of travel restrictions. So I have a lot of different tunings that I play in. And so I thought, as I was tuning the guitar, which I can do because we have little tuners now, and you can mute the guitar so people don't have to hear it, I have learned to talk over the tuning process, which is boring to watch. And it has really helped me communicate with the audience, which I didn't used to do so much as speaking, but more as singing. And it's really been great for me because, I love to, the smaller things we're doing now with the house concerts and the small venues. Before, when we played bigger venues, you never met the people. Mm-hmm. There was like a barrier between the two. And it's so great to talk to the people before the show and have them request stuff during the show and talk to them after the show. It's a really nice thing. And I'm glad that I'm doing it like that. It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I think your music is personal and something that you really engage people when you play your songs. And so I think house concerts and small settings like that are perfect for your music.
I love it. It's just great.
Yeah. Do you remember the first song you wrote?
Well, yeah, because I've been writing songs since I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I think the very first song I wrote, I think I was probably in fourth grade, was the very poignant song "My Belly Button's Orange, Not Green, But Orange." Was the hook? No idea where that came from.
It sounds like a psychedelic song.
Could have been, yeah. So I think that was probably my first original, which I don't play much live anymore. But I always kind of knew that. Songs always kind of came to me, ideas and melodies and lyrics, and so I think that people as writers and musicians or actors or whatever you are, I think you know at a very early age that this is kind of the path you need to go on. And if you're lucky enough and, you know, deliver when you're supposed to deliver, you can make it a career.
Yeah. When you know it's your passion and it's something you can't live without doing, you know, that's when you sure. know it's what you got to do.
True, and it doesn't feel like work when you're doing it. I mean, you know, making a record and rehearsing, and it's all a pain, but the end goal is you're out there and you're playing for people, and, you know, the songs that you write, even though they are for us, some people relate to your song like you wrote it, you know, especially for them, and so it's great to connect with people like that where they hear a song and say, wow, that was something that I've been feeling, and it's great to hear you singing about it. So that's also a great joy.
So you've always been pretty prolific in songwriting and creating music?
Pretty much. I mean, I learned a great discipline when I went on to the TV show as a musician. Before that, you know, you wrote songs, you took your time, you wrote when you felt like it. But when I got my network TV show, which was in 1996, a new show was being developed that was a spinoff of Touched by an Angel, and it was called Promised Land. And I got a shot to be the composer on the show, and I worked my butt off and got the gig. And I never, never had worked under deadlines, which was maybe 3-4 days. And having to do 12 to 20 minutes of fully orchestrated music. And it taught me a great, great lesson that even though you think the mountain's too high, you can climb it, but you just have to try harder. So I've kind of used that post-TV work in my songwriting and my recording now. It's something that I know that, you know, you can't just do it when you feel good. You have to just keep plowing through it because you never know what's going to come out. So you just keep playing music and recording music. And don't be lazy. You know, there's no time to be lazy now.
So do you write every day then now?
No, I don't know that I write every day, but I'm doing something creative every day. I started doing these on-camera concert window concerts, which has been really kind of fun, where I stream live shows in my studio here. And that's really fun. And that's a really creative thing because you're kind of doing it in real time. You're communicating with people who are watching the show on camera. And the first one I did, I just did with a camera and my wife, and it felt really sterile. So we invited our neighbors over. So now when I do one of those, we have people here, which is easier for me to kind of perform and feel like I'm really at a gig because there's mm-hmm. people right in front of me instead of just staring at a camera lens.
Mm-hmm. Is that on Facebook or where can people see those?
The platform is called Concert Window. Mm-hmm. And there are people that play on there all the time. And I'll probably be doing one at the end of this month. And I usually announce them on Facebook. And all you got to do is go to Concert Window and type in an act of their name. And like my name will pop up there. So it's just really a lot of fun. And you do live requests from the people that are watching it. And it's like a Kickstarter thing as well, where people can tip you and they get, you know, a CD collection, or they can get a CD or a signed poster or something. So it's really fun. It's a really nice, fun event.
Cool. Yeah, that's awesome. They can they can see you perform without having to go, you know, out to a gig, wait for you to come back to their town or something.
Yeah, especially in the wintertime. You know, I don't like traveling in the winter. It's just so unpredictable and dangerous at times. Mm-hmm. So it's really a great way to keep playing. And also it's good for me to be playing, because when you rehearse to go on the road, it's not the same as playing the songs in front of people. So it's really good to keep my chops up and keep me on my toes. So I like that pressure.
So are you usually doing just a song, or are you doing a full performance? What are you usually doing on those?
I've been averaging about an hour 10.
Oh.
There's a ticket price that you set. You know, some people play for free, which, well, I don't do that. Usually it's a $15 to $20 ticket, like it would be if you went to a house concert.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very intimate, and it really is a lot of fun. I'm really glad. It took me a long time to learn the technical side of it, because as you know, this technical stuff is really great, but getting it all to work at the right time, especially streaming, which is, you know, you're streaming it live back to the place that's hosting it, and they're beaming it out to all these people, so it's amazing that it works. And it took me about a month and a half to finally get it to work, but it's really fun. It really is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch one of those. That sounds fun. Going back to Next Stop Willoughby, there's a couple of songs I want to ask you about on it. The song that I really like a lot on there is Sure Could Use Some Love. What was the inspiration for that song?
Well, I think it's, you know, you're always influenced by what's going on around the world. And needless to say, the last year and a half or so has been different.
to say the least.
Yeah, to say the least. And so, you know, I kind of go back to my early roots in the 60s and 70s. And it just feels like, you know, everybody gets so caught up in their life and, you know, with the politics. And it just feels like you need to slow down. And music is such a great, great soothing healer. And it feels like sometimes we're losing that passion in life. And that's what that song is really about.
How about the song Don't It Make You Wonder Why?
Well, that song was inspired by, it's a song about, you know, but in my life, you know, over the many years I've been doing music, there have been times when I have been either driving or at a live show, and I hear a song that just absolutely kills me from the very beginning, and you don't know why that song is killing you when the person next to you is just kind of enjoying it, but it doesn't have the same impact on you. I've seen this all through the years, how people say, God, that song was so great. And I always wondered what it was. So I wrote a song, Don't It Make You Wonder Why? Why does this one make me cry? I don't think anybody really knows. But that, going back to what I talked about earlier, that, you know, we never know as songwriters who we're writing the songs for. And it's so great to see that person in the audience that maybe that song was written for them, and to see them connect. And it's a great, great experience.
Do you ever have people approach you and say, can I perform this one song of yours?
Oh, yeah, it's great. And some people send me films of them playing it. It's really cool.
Yeah. I had a friend of mine got hold of me yesterday and asked me if he could start playing one of my songs. And afterward, he goes, I think that's one of your best songs you've ever written. And I'm like, really? What do you get out of that song that you think is so great? You just wonder why, you know?
That's exactly. Very true.
One of the songs that you, is sort of more of a socially conscious song on the album, is They Can't Have Everything. Do you think that musicians should be letting their social views and political views be known more nowadays?
Well, you know, I do it in a way that's, I try to make it still kind of funny, because otherwise it makes you crazy and people get angry. And just for me to see in my adult life, you know, I'm 65 now, you know, in my 20s and 30s, and even before that, there was just such a nice middle class. And it seems like it has gotten squeezed away. And it was like what I used to hear Europe was like, where there was the rich and there were the, you know, the other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what kind of, for me, it feels like what's kind of happening here in our country. So I just thought I'd write a little song about it and do a little turnaround at the end where I, you know, talk about my wife, which it really isn't about my wife, to make it funny, because, you know, we have to keep some kind of sense of humor going, because otherwise we just get chaos.
Yeah, you can get a point across if you use a little humor more than if you hit somebody over the head with the point, I think.
And people don't seem to get offended. I mean, they're laughing, mm-hmm. you know, even though you might have different political views or different views about life. If you make it where people can see the humor in it, then the message is so much better.
Mm-hmm. So you came to California from Ohio as a teenager back in the late 60s. I always wondered, and you were like, what, 15, 16 years old?
I was 15. I had just gone through ninth grade, and, you know, I'd been in a lot of bands, and I was always kind of advanced as a player and a singer, and I was always kind of the lead guy, and I played wheelchair electric piano, and there was a band in Dayton called The Loved Ones that was kind of the biggest band of that particular area, and they had asked me if I'd be interested in joining the band, and they were planning to go to California for a couple of months and just see if they could get some record interest. So they were 19 and 20 years old. We had a manager who was in his late 20s and a mother who was a chaperone. It was a big family affair. And so we rented a house out in California and started doing gigs and got an audition with Atlantic Records. And that's where I initially met Ahmet Erdogan. And then we were supposed to go back to Ohio. And I was going to go back to my sophomore year. And then the band broke up. We got a deal and the band broke up because people got greedy before the record was even made. And I decided at that point that I was not going to go back to Ohio. I knew that being in California was where I needed to be. So I stayed there and stayed there until 2015 when my wife and I moved here to Central Oregon.
So did your parents worry about you being out there? I mean, because this is back when a lot of turmoil was going on. Did they not worry about you being out there?
Well, my mother and father had just gotten divorced, and my mom was left with four kids, and I was the oldest. And she worried a lot, but, you know, I think in the end it was easier for her to be supporting three kids instead of four, and my sister was old enough that she could help. So I've always been supported by them. It drove her crazy, you know, the first couple of years. Actually, the first year was the worst, and she always tried to get me to come back, and I just said, you know, this is where I need to be, and so they were fine with it. They, you know, I didn't die, I didn't OD or anything, so I kind of always had kind of a clear head and tried not to get caught up in stuff that I shouldn't be caught up in.
Yeah, it's great that your parents were supportive like that and didn't, you know, say, no, come home now. Because, I mean, they could have put their foot down and said no, you know.
Yeah, they could have had me arrested and sent home.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So how was Bettdorf and Rodney formed?
I met Mark in Las Vegas. I moved there for a few months in 1970. And I met Mark. I was performing at a coffee shop there at the University of Las Vegas. And, you know, I was a solo guy, and I had all these songs. And this guy kept wanting to jam with me, and I finally let him come up and jam. And it turned out that it was really, really great. And so we got really, really tight with all the songs and went to California and ended up auditioning for Ahmet Erdogan. And we got a deal and went to Muscle Shoals. And it was... I think it was March of 1971 and cut our very first album off the shelf.
So you got to work with Rich Hill, is that right?
No, Ahmet Erdogan was the president. He was the guy.
Okay.
He was the president of Atlantic Records.
Okay, I was just thinking the guy who ran the studio down in, is it Alabama? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, this was when they had split up into two different places, and they had the really great musicians who were at the other place.
Okay.
Started their own thing, and we were with those guys. They were fantastic.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's stories of legend there.
Oh, without a doubt, they made so many great hit records there. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So you guys were inducted into the Las Vegas Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What has that meant to you to know that that's something that's happened in your life?
Well, it's actually pretty ironic because we actually were both from Los Angeles and ended up meeting in Las Vegas. And subsequently, we became Hall of Famers for Las Vegas because that's where we met and that's where we practiced. And so it was great in 2012 to get recognized. Like, that was fantastic.
So Bettdorf and Rodney's music has stood the test of time. Why do you think that's true? I mean, you've kept those fans for all these years. How come you think your music is still as popular today as ever?
Well, I just think it's because at that time, the music business was different, and people just don't forget. I was just in Texas, and there were people that came to my show at a house concert that saw us play in Lubbock, Texas in 1974, and they still live there. And it made this incredible impact on them. And here we are, you know, gosh, 43 years later, 44 years later, and they're at my show. And it was really cool. They knew the songs. It was just great.
Do you ever get back together with Mark Rodney?
You know, we did for a brief time. We ended up going back to XM Radio, and we made a live in-studio record, and then we went out on the road for a little bit, but it's just kind of not what Mark wants to do now. So it was fun while it lasted, but, you know, it's come and gone, and it was cool. He played on my Home Again CD, and it was fun to play with him again, but, you know, it's really hard to go back because it's kind of great when you first reunite, but... You know, I'd kind of gone some other way, and so had he. And even though you kind of capture it for a little bit, it's not the same as it was when you first got together. That's mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, you can't go home again, as they say.
No, it's just not the same.
Tell me about the band Silver. At what point did you join that band, and how did that band come about?
Well, the way the band happened was Mark and I split up, and we were getting ready to make our fourth album with Arista. And Clive Davis, who was the president of Arista, you know, he really liked us, and he really wanted us to break out because we were a big FM band, but we didn't have any hit singles. So he had two songs that he wanted us to record, and one of them was Somewhere in the Night, which we ended up recording, and it was somewhat of a hit. And then this other song he wanted us to record, which I could not believe he was asking us to do, was a song called Wham Bam Shang-a-Lang. I really hated it because it was, you know, we had some musical integrity, and Somewhere in the Night was a beautiful song. And I didn't mind singing that because it was a great song. And this goofy song, I thought, well, I can't sing this with a straight face on stage. I'm going to feel really dumb. And so we went in, we cut it, and then we broke up. And I met with Clive Davis and said, I don't want to do Bad Wolf and Ride anymore, but I have these two other guys that I'd like you to hear. If you can give us a couple of weeks, we'll get something together. So we went and auditioned for Clive 2 weeks later. It was Brent Midland, myself, and Greg Collier just sitting in the room playing for him, and he loved it and said, you know, I want to sign you guys. I think you guys are really great. But here's the situation. I think Wham Bam is going to be a hit record, and what we need to do is replace Mark's parts with the new guys from Silver. And because it's a new band, we'll release it before the album's out. So if you guys agree to release Wham Bam as a Silver record, I'll do the album with you. So we said, what the heck, you know? So we thought it would probably be a flop. And so we put the record out, and then it started climbing the charts like crazy and got to number 16, which is the highest charted record I'd ever had. And then a year later, we were back to do another album, and it didn't work out. The record label didn't like the new material and started giving us really goofy songs to do, so we just split up. And that was kind of the end of it. I even when I listened to the Silver album, I'd always skip over that song because I just, the band was really good. And, I mean, the hit was a really good pop hit record, but it wasn't like what the band was. So, you know, then it just kind of moved on, and then life went on, and never even thought about it. And then last May, I was back in New York, and somebody sent me a link to Rolling Stone. And I checked it out, and I saw that there was a new movie out called Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and they had this 70s soundtrack, this mixtape thing, and I saw all these incredible hits were on there. And as I scrolled down, I saw... Wham Bam Shang-a-Lang by Silver. And I thought, well, this is crazy. I said, you know, I know it was a hit, but it's not like these hits. As it turned out, that the producer heard the song, loved it, and said, I want this in the movie. And it's really a trip. I mean, it was like 41 years ago. So I went to the movies with my wife here in up in Bend, Oregon, and I still couldn't really believe it till I saw it in the movie. I thought maybe it's just on the soundtrack and not in the movie. And there it was, in a big scene in the movie.
Yeah, it's a major part of the movie. It's like the big fight scene there. So
that was great. Yeah. Couldn't believe it. So you know, now I started doing it in the show. You know, just like a verse chorus, just because I thought it was pretty humorous, and then. Because it was such a big hit, it had its own YouTube page. It had almost 8 million hits on it.
Wow.
So I was here in the summertime, and we had a lot of forest fires, and I was kind of trapped in my house. I couldn't go outside, so I thought, well, maybe I should record some stuff. So I thought, well, you know, it would be kind of cool to go back and pick maybe, you know, 15 songs or so from the past. I've recorded so many songs, and just redo them as, you know, where they would all kind of sound like they were done at the same time, which they are. But these songs were recorded over so many different years, different studios, different bands. And because I really, the smoke continued, I couldn't do anything else but record. So I recorded a really cool acoustic version of Wham Bam and Somewhere in the Night and You Are a Song, which were songs I didn't write, but it was really cool to go back and do them. And then I started picking some Bat Dorf and Rodney songs, some Bat Dorf and McLean songs, some Silver songs. And now I'm kind of right in the heart of making the record. As a matter of fact, right before we started the interview, I was working on Life Is You, which is from the third Bat Dorf and Rodney record. So I've been here singing lead vocals and playing guitars and trying to get this new record, which is going to be called Me and My Guitar, and hopefully be out in May. So you'll be getting your copy.
Great. That's awesome. So you have a Kickstarter project for that, right?
Yeah, it's got 2 weeks left.
So tell people how they can help you out with that.
It's going to be done by March 29, and all they do is go on Kickstarter and type in my name, John Bat Dorf, and the project, Me and My Guitar. And basically, you can get in by just, you're just pre-buying the album, and some people have been very generous with their pledges. And what it does for the artists, which is really great, because, you know, artists like myself, we don't have record deals anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's this fan-based support is so great, because the people who love your music want you to keep doing it. And it's no matter, even if you have your own studio, you're still in at least $10,000 to $15,000 to make a record. There's just no way getting around it. Mm-hmm. And what this Kickstarter has done is, you know, they offer another platform where fans can help support your record and make pledges, and then they get some really cool stuff from the artists. So many of my friends are doing this now. It's a nice thing. It's because in the old days, when, you know, the only way you could make a record is if you had a record deal. And the record business is so weird now. But this has been this whole new wave of indie acts doing, and I think most of the people that I know who make records use Kickstarter or Pledge Music or another form of Indiegogo is another one, where fans reach out and try to help so you don't have to sell one of your kids to make a record.
So for this Kickstarter thing that you've done and called the Me and My Guitar project, are there songs on there that you were surprised by, that you went back and you were kind of re-listening to and reworking and you were like, yeah, this was actually a great song?
Well, yeah, it's so fun to, because I've always moved forward. I always like to move forward, and I was just kind of trapped here, and I started listening to these old songs and started trying to do new arrangements on it, kind of like the same process with All Wooden Stones. And so you're kind of reinventing the song and making it interesting again, but still keeping the original charm that was there before when you wrote it back, you know, in 1971. I also am putting on two brand new songs because I wanted to have two new songs on the record, and they'll be a little bit more produced than the other one because I wanted to make the other really kind of simple with just acoustic guitars, bass, cajon, a little bit of harmony. Mm-hmm. And the new ones will be a little more produced, but it's still going to be, you know, me and my guitar. So that's why we called it that.
That's great. I can't wait to hear it because I love, you know, just stripped down acoustic music. So that sounds great.
It is great. It is great. It's kind of like you're being at a house concert with the full band there, you know, with the cajon and the bass player and another guitar player. It's really cool.
Mm-hmm. So what was your first guitar?
Well, my dad, I used to use my dad's old Gibson, and then it got broken. Because my dad says when I was a kid, I ended up, because I took lessons since I was 5. My dad said I slid down the guitar neck, was propped up against a chair, and broke the neck off that guitar. Mm-hmm. So I ended up actually was playing keyboards, a Wurlitzer electric piano. And when I came to California and the Buffalo Springfield came out and I heard these really cool acoustic bands, I traded in one of my amps for a Yamaha acoustic, which is kind of like a Martin knockoff. And I've been playing acoustic guitar ever since.
What was your first electric guitar? Because I know there's a picture of you on Facebook with you and a guitar. What guitar was that?
I think the very first one I had was probably a Les Paul. And then I had some Les Paul Juniors. I've had so many guitars, it's sick. Old Strat. You know, it's just, we just kind of trade them in and somebody else uses them and you move on to something else.
Yeah. Very cool. I wanted to talk a little bit, too, about Soundtracks to Recovery. That's been a really important project that you've done in the last couple of years. Can you tell everybody a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was, you know, inspired by an event with my son who became addicted to drugs. And the way that we finally reached him through, you know, there were so many other efforts that failed, was through a song that I wrote called I Don't Always Win. And it was the first time that we actually got through to him and the communications opened up. And so Michael McLean and myself decided that we wanted to make a full album like that. And so we did. We wrote all these songs and went and tested them. We went to a recovery conference and played these songs for people, and they really resonated with them. So we made a record called Soundtracks to Recovery, and someone donated a website to us, which is the number 2recovery.org. We talk about the project and also offer the music for free to people that feel like they need the music but can't afford to buy it. We just let them take it.
Yeah, so the website for that is www.2recovery.org.
Yes.
And go check that out. If you know somebody who's in trouble, it's a great place to maybe give them a little help up a little bit. So, John, thank you so much for taking the time and talking with me today. You can find John Batdorf at johnbatdorfmusic.com, and his music, all his music, is available at CD Baby, iTunes, Amazon. And you also have a buy site on your website as well, which you probably prefer people use, right?
I do.
So you can go check out that. And then he's also on Facebook, Twitter, and you can check out some videos on YouTube. Once again, tell them about the live things that you're doing.
It's on Concert Window, and they're live from my studio with 5 or 6 people here sitting in the room listening. And they're really a lot of fun. And you can check them out on my website. I post them on my website. And you can also sign up on my email list on my website, and you know all the information when I'm coming to town or when I'm doing some event that I think you might want to come check out.
All right. Well, it's been great hearing your new album, Next Stop Willoughby, and we're looking forward to Me and My Guitar coming out later this year as well.
Thank you so much, Kathy. Nice talking to you again.